Thank you, Yael. Okay, a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Dr. Benjamin Samuels, Rabbi of Congregation Sha'arei Tvila in Newton. And that's it. That's it for the introduction. I'm sorry, I forgot to mention Yael teaches at Matan. I said we're not doing real introduction, just like one sentence introduction. Rabbi Samuels is going to talk about how many Hanukkah candles, the development of halakha in light of Talmudic interpretation, science, technology, and Vakasha. Rabbi Samuels, I think you're here. I mean, I know.
Yeah, no, I'm here. You want to make me a co-host?
Yeah, I did already. I made you co-host. You can take off your jacket and relax, but if you want to be formal, that's also
okay.
Fine.
Okay. Thank you,
Rabbi Vakasha.
Thank
you have your full 29 minutes. You can go 5 minutes overtime from, you know, the official time. Okay.
Thank you, everyone, for joining during this time of darkness and anxiety while Israel is at war. And I want to give a yash koach to Rav Jay and to all of us to join our resources of energy and time for a zechut for our chayalim and chayalot, for the hope of the return of the chatupim and chatupot, all of the hostages. And may it herald a Hanukkah of light and hope and yeshuot v'nechamot bayamim ahem u'bazman hazeh. Yimir tzashem, it should happen. I want to thank all of the previous presenters who really delivered spectacular presentations. I hope I will merit a percentage of their excellence. But in particular, I want to thank Professor Kohler for his excellent Talmudic analysis of the Sugya and Masechet Shabbat on how many Hanukkah candles, and Professor Stephen Fine on the material history of the Chanukiah, because both of those really are part one and part two of my class that I hope then to move to part C and spend our half an hour together on that part C. Just for those who rejoined, I'll review a tiny bit of the sugya and account a tiny bit of the material history, and then go to my presentation. But the question that comes up is, and I'm going to share the screen, how many Hanukkah lights do we light per our halachic and folk practice? And so please give me a thumbs up if you could see the screen. Excellent.
Blank screen.
Blank screen.
So not in the slides.
It's not supposed to be a blank screen.
Right. We see it, but it's not. That's not.
Okay. So let me try again. Okay. Here we go. Share screen. Screen number one. Okay. How about now?
Perfect. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. So the question is, how many Hanukkah lights? And we start with the sugya and Masechet Shabbat. I have here, I think this is the Koren Noah edition of the Tanakh. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught in a braita, mitzvat Chanukah, that the mitzvah of Chanukah, which is a rabbinic commandment that follows the victory of the Hasmoneans over the Syrian Greeks in 165 BCE, the mitzvah of Hanukkah near Ishuveto is one candle per man and his household. It's a patriarchal structure, a man and his household. The Hamehadrin, and for those who pursue mitzvot or for those who beautify mitzvot, that depends on Rashi pursuing mitzvot. We heard that from Dr. Kohler. Rambam says it means to beautify mitzvot following Hidur mitzvah. The concept of beautifying mitzvot and glorifying God through our dignifying our mitzvot through an aesthetic excellence is near l'chol echad v'echad, that on each of the nights of Hanukkah, we should light one candle for every member of the household. And then beyond the normal beautification of mitzvah, on Hanukkah itself, we have something unique, which is mahadrin min hamahadrin. Those who are excessively scrupulous in pursuing mitzvot, or those who are excessively scrupulous in aesthetic excellence and want to beautify the mitzvah, there's a third layer. And that involves adding a candle following Beit Hillel successively for the eight nights of Hanukkah. So on the first night, we start with one. On the eighth night, we finish with eight candles, not including, of course, the shamash. And here we come to a structural question in analyzing this Talmudic sugya. And that structural question is whether level three builds off of level two, or it's an alternative path building off of level one. Meaning we have three levels of mitzvah practice. We have the basic mitzvah, we have mahadrin, the first level of enhancement, and then we have mahadrin mina mahadrin, a second level of enhancement. And there's just a literary structural question, which the Rishonim analyze, and that asks, does level three build off of level two, or is it an independent path? So if we look at Tosafot, and here Tosafot is credited to the Ri, who's Rabbi Yitzchak of Dampier. He lived in the 12th century. He's said to have died in 1185, perhaps the most off-sited Tosafist by name, and his academy produced the most prestigious rabbis of the next generation. Although there was no formal religious hierarchy in Franco-Germany at this time, he was the nephew and disciple of Rav Yaakov Tam, who was the grandson of Rashi and the leading sage of the first half of the 12th century. So both by his genealogical associations and his renowned knowledge and great spirit, he assumed the rabbinical leadership for Ashkenaz in the second half of the 12th century. And the Ri says it appeared to Rabbi Yitzchak that the Academy of Shammai and the Academy of Hillel only established their dispute upon the principal ruling of one candle per man per household. For there's greater beautification of the mitzvah in that there's greater recognition when one adds an additional candle each successive night or subtracts a candle in accordance with the days entering or going out. However, if one lights a candle per person in the household, even if one adds an additional candle each night, then you will have no idea what night of Hanukkah it is. If you have five people in the household and it's the seventh night of Hanukkah and you light 35 candles, then someone walking by might think it's the 35th night of Hanukkah, which doesn't, of course, make sense. But if you have six candles lit, are there three people in the household in the second night, or are there two people in the household and it's the sixth night of Hanukkah? So if the idea is to publicize the miracle outwardly, then according to the Ri, there can only be either a path one or a path two of enhancement, but not a building of the third level on the second level, because then people won't be able to notice. So here I have a graphic to make this clear, I hope, to everyone. Level one, near Ishuveto, one candle per household. Level two, near Lekol Echad Ba'Echad, you have four people in the household, you have four candles. Level 2B, right, Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, a second path of Mahadrin, Mosi Beholech Lifnei Beit Hillel, you add one light. On the eighth night of Hanukkah, you have eight candles plus the shamash. Everyone walking by will notice that it's the eighth night of Hanukkah. Now, that's not the only interpretation. There is another line of interpretation, which, again, is the other possibility of structural analysis of this sugya. And that is that level three builds off of level two, that builds off of level one. And this is the Shitat HaRambam. The Rambam, says that his preferred interpretation and his ideal practice would be Neri Shubeto, one candle per person, level two, one candle per person in the household, and level three, one candle per person in the household, adding a different light for each night of Hanukkah for those of us who are Ashkenaz and not Edot HaMizrach or Yotzei Sfarad. This is our practice, right? We light, like the Rambam says, one Chanukiah per member of the household. Interestingly, B'nai Ashkenaz follow the Rambam, and B'nai Sfarad follow Shitat Tosafot. That itself is a halacha curiosity, that you have Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch, mentioning that the halacha follows the position of, he doesn't say the position of Tosafot, he just cites the position that we attribute to Tosafot. And then the Ramah says that our custom is to follow the Rambam, which is the Yeshomrim, the Cholachad Mibnei Abayit Yadlik. There are those that say that every one of the household should light an additional candle. Ze v'chein min hakapashut, and that is the general custom of Ashkenaz in Eastern Europe, of Western and Eastern Europe, which is attributed to the Rambam. So the Bach and the Taz and others note this is a curiosity that you have Ashkenazim following Sephardic Psak and Sephardim following Ashkenazic Psak. There is more to that story than that simple analysis. And the reason for that is I would claim that the basic structural analysis of the sugya leads to both Tosafot and the Rambam. And we have some evidence of the Rambam's position preceding the Rambam, going back at least to the Rif, according to the Vilna Gaon. And also Tosafist position is cited by other Sephardic Rishonim, although they are later than the Tosafot. So the question is, are they just citing Tosafot? Are they have their own independent tradition of interpretation of that sugya, or did they come up with it on their own? But those are the two practices. Sfarad tends to have one Chanukiah for the whole household, and Bnei Ashkenaz one Chanukiah per person. So this is, and Professor Kohler elaborated on that with further halachic analysis. But what I would like to bring to this discussion, conversation, and study is to view this sugya not only through the lens of Talmudic analysis and not only through the lens of material history of Judaica that Professor Fine brought, but to also view this through the lens of the history of technology, the history of material history and social history. So if we view this sugya through these lenses, well, now we have to expand our consideration of several elements of our practice of Hanukkah lighting. First of all, we have to discuss the question of the history of home architecture, the presence of courtyards or lack of frontal courtyards. We have to talk about doorways, their size, where they were situated. And most importantly, we have to talk about windows. What were windows like in different places throughout history? When we hear the word window, what do we think of? We think of, and how, you know, we think of a glass window that's opening to a public thoroughfare. So what is the history of windows? We also have to talk about fuel. Right. We know Bamem Madlikim, the Mishnah in the second chapter of Masechet Shabbat talks about different wicks and oils. So we want to know, right, what were the cost of different types of fuel? What were their efficiencies? You know, and what were they lit in? That was the social history the material history of the Judaica item. And as Professor Fine pointed out, even though we have from the Torah, the physical architecture of the vessel of the menorah, right, it seems like the Chanukiah is a medieval product. There is a claim that a Chanukiah was found that dates from Bayit Sheni shortly after Hanukkah. It's housed in a museum in Borough Park. They said that they'd done carbon dating on it. It's a unique relic, but it would seem that the proscription of modeling vessels after the vessels in the Beit HaMikdash really proscribed and constrained the innovation of a Chanukiah until much later. It's a little unclear. We don't know what we don't know, but what we do know is that the Chanukiot that we have are medieval and late medieval at that 13th century and later. And then we have to view this not only through the apparatus, but through climate. geography. And then we have to view this also through the social history of what was it like to, for Jews to live in Christendom and in the Islamic orbit. Of course, Christendom has a competing winter holiday that occurs every year at roughly the same time, which would create competing religious practices, whereas the Muslim calendar following a lunar calendar has its holy month Ramadan cycling throughout the year as all of the other Muslim holidays, and there wouldn't be a direct competition between the winter holiday of Hanukkah and Muslim holidays at that same time. So if one looks at our practice through all of these different lenses, it really adds further dimension to the development of our practices. I would like for today to solely look at this through the question of windows. And so let me show you what I mean. So where do we place the Chanukiah? Near Chanukah, menicho al petach hasamuch l'reshut harabim. It should be at the entrance, which is closest to the public thoroughfare, mibachutz, outside. Im habayit patuach l'reshut harabim, maniach al pitcho. If the house opens to a public way, then place it at the entrance. Ve'im yesh chatzir lifnei habayit, and if there is a front courtyard, menicho al petach hachatzir, then you should place it at the front of the courtyard facing the public thoroughfare. Why do we do this? Because the purpose is to outwardly publicize the holiday and its miracle. Ve'imaya darba aliyah, if you live in a loft, and the question is, how many stories are we talking here? Probably only two stories at this point. Later, we're going to have to contend with higher stories, including high-rise skyscrapers today. She'en lo petach patuach l'reshut harabim, which doesn't have an entrance to the public thoroughfare. Manicho b'chalo. You have to place it in a chalon, which we're going to translate now. It is a window. Hasamuch l'reshut harabim, that is closest or outward facing to the public way. Uvishata sakana, and when there is a danger of persecution, sheinu rashai l'kayem ha-mitzvah, when we're unable to perform the mitzvah, maniach al shulchano b'dayo, place it in on your dining table, and that's enough. Okay, but tzarich nerach acher lishtamesh l'oro, and then we have the shamash. I'm not going to get into that. So I want to focus on the word chalon. Because the word chalon, like the word menorah, or the later development, as Professor Fine pointed out, of Chanukiah, the word chalon is a word that has a continuity of usage from the time of the Talmud until today. However, there's a great variance in what it means. And we find this throughout intellectual history, that we have continuity of terminology, but variance in meaning, which makes it very difficult for those of us in a contemporary generation to read ancient texts and then decode words that have had a continuity of meaning, but impose our current understanding upon them when they meant something else differently in ages past. This is a problem that was identified in the philosophy of science and the philosophy of language. This is a problem. And those who are interested in the history of science and the philosophy of science will often turn to this question of the terminology, continuity, but variance in meaning to try to decipher what is the true unfolding of its history. So what I want to talk about is chalon, place it in a chalon. When is it possible to place a Chanukiah in a window? Now, many of us today have reclaimed in Ashkenaz, even those that us who live in a country that has a Christian majority, when there's a competing festival of a different religion at the same time, of placing our Chanukiot in our windows. And we display both inwardly and outwardly how many nights of Hanukkah is. And because we have a Chanukiah that groups together the number of candles, so it's clear what night of Chanukiah it is. When we pass by a window with 35 candles, we don't see 35 similar looking candles. We see seven Chanukiot with five candles each, or we see five Chanukiot with seven candles each. So because of the material culture of the development of the Chanukiah and the distinction of each Chanukiah and the number of nights of Chanukah, it is proclaiming, right? Then we could even use the Rambam's position of every person in the household lighting their own Chanukiah with the number of candles as a device of Pirsumei Nisa outside as well. But that all depends, right, on the material culture as well as the opportunity. But let's get back to Chalon. So this is really interesting. Because the word chalon or window really means an opening in the side of the building. And in ancient days, people had openings in their buildings, whatever their buildings were constructed from. However, those openings were shuttered. And during the winter, you usually shuttered those windows and you placed fabric or some insulating material in the crevices in the cracks so that you can insulate your home against the cold. If you lived in a colder climate, you would not open your windows except on a very temperate day to air out the house. And if you lived in a warmer climate, then you might open your windows. So the idea of plate glass windows, where we have an opening to the exterior of the world from our houses, that are filled in with a transparent glass that provides a clear view both inside and outside inside, is a relatively modern phenomenon. I came across this idea when I was listening to a book by a wonderful author by the name of Bill Bryson. He started out as a travel writer, and then he wrote a brief history of nearly everything, which is a history of science. And then he followed that up with a book called At Home, A Short History of Private Life. And he gives a history of home, and he really talks about so many things. What's the hall for? Why do our windows still have shutters, even though we don't use those shutters? He goes through a history of every room of the house. And then I was listening to it. It was an Audible book, but although in front of us we have the written copy, he speaks about the history of windows and of glass. And I did a little more research into it, and I bring some of that. So glass making, of course, is a Roman invention. It was known in the ancient world, and it continues in the medieval period and continues to increase. But the glass windows that were created during the medieval period, we really don't have evidence of glass windows before the medieval period, are small glass windows, like stained glass windows. Here's a woodcut by Pfefferkorn, a Gentile artist of a shul in Cologne in 1508. And you see, we have small panes of glass soldered with lead solder together, and we have two windows here. Now, lest you don't want to trust a woodcut, here is a photograph of the old synagogue in Erfurt. Erfurt Synagogue made history this year because actually a postdoc at Harvard this year, who is a member of my synagogue, Shimon Levine Waldman, was part of a team that used the DNA of the teeth of Jews who died as martyrs in a persecution in Erfurt in the medieval period to do a genetic analysis of those teeth. But without getting into that issue, right? You see very few windows, very small, and the windows that it had again would have been these very small pane glass windows. And when we look to windows that are depicted throughout that, this comes from a collection of ephemera from 1654 to the 1860s, right? Shopkeepers, you see all again these small pane glass windows. It is only in the 19th century that the technology developed to make large pane glass windows. That was a technology developed in France. And even before that, windows were so prized, they were considered a luxury item that were taxed twofold. One, you were taxed if you had a glass window in your house. And two, you were taxed by the weight of the glass used in the window. So glass windows that we take for granted as part of just the architecture of our homes really don't come into existence on a mass scale until the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. And certainly pane glass windows that have large displays. And so if that's the case, then windows really aren't a vehicle of displaying our Chanukiot until the late modern period as well. Now, if you take that into account with the idea that people who lived in geographies with cold climates would not be opening at night their shutters to their windows to display their Chanukiot, and that until you the glass boxes that we're familiar with from Yerushalayim, until you could come up with that innovation, it's going to be very hard to have external outward displays of Chanukiot. On top of that, as some have opined, like the Knesset Yechezkel writing in the Tshuva, that Jews who lived in Christian lands with competing holidays were afraid to light outside. And the Rambam mentioned, and in a time of sakana, you put it on shulchano, your dining room table, v'dayo, and that's sufficient. The pirsum hanes goes on the inside of the house rather than the outside of the house. Jews who lived in Muslim countries where there wasn't a competing winter festival, and at times they enjoyed more security, but there were times of security in Christendom as well. But the climate also favored the possibility of lighting outside at the entrance of your courtyard or opening your shutters to light outside. Then there would be a greater ability to publicize the miracle, not only inwardly, but outwardly. And if you're publicizing the miracle outwardly and you really care about that, then you will follow the position of Tosafot, not because it's a better interpretation of the Gemara, but because it more clearly is the best way to publicize the amount of nights that Hanukkah has passed. When you're lighting principally for in-house, not outward, then even absent the technology of a Chanukiah that distinguishes per person how many lights there are, then for the inside of the house, everyone knows what night of Hanukkah it is. Then you focus on each individual's religious fulfillment of the Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin, of lighting their path. So what I hope to accomplish in this brief period of time is just to add another dimension to the analysis of how many Hanukkah lights that builds off of the Talmudic analysis of the Gemara and the Rishonim and the Achronim, and the material history of the Chanukiah itself, and then expands it to not only the social history of Jews and their security in the West and in Eastern Europe and Central Europe and in the Eidot HaMizrach and Sfarad and Mideastern lands of a better climate and a different, at times, cultural surrounding in Sfarad, but also through the lens of technology, here focusing on how the continuity of terminology of windows actually means different things at different times because of the advance of technology. We could do a similar presentation on the production and uses of oil from antiquity until the modern period. And the last thing that I would say is that just as Chanukah, according to Beit Hillel, is Mosif Beholech Malim Bekodesh, so viewing this sugya through the lens of technology is also a fulfillment of Rav Kook's famous saying of Hayashan Yitchadesh, that the old shall be renewed, v'hagadash yitkadesh, and the new shall be sanctified. As technology advances, we find new ways to fulfill halacha in a superlative fashion, a mahadrin, mina mahadrin fashion, and the history of how many Hanukkah lights is a display of this phenomenon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't know if you want to take a 30-second look at some of the quick questions, comments. You have a minute to answer them if you'd like.
Yeah, sure. Why don't you read them to me, Jay?
Okay, so very quickly, let's see. Somebody's asking why our Chanukiah have 9 candles often. That's, I know Danny Sperber has a whole article about that in his whole volume on Minhagei, so a whole volume on Chanukah. Are you familiar with that, Rabbi?
It's been a while since I read article, but
the 9 is because of the dual purpose of the shamash, to provide light and to light from one candle to another. So some people develop the custom. Oh, that's why you have actually 10. You have eight tonight and then two extra shamashim. But okay, let me just read you the question.
But by the way, that question, the use of an individual candle for shamash as an addition to either Neri Shubeto, the basic level, or the Mahadran Mina Mahadran, also builds off of the question of how much did oil cost, and the uses of it. So that does have a function of it. We take for granted, we have lots of shamashim in our overhead lighting, but we still light the shamash, even if we turn on the overhead light, or some people, right?
Right. 100%. Okay. Someone asking if you're, glass window faces the backyard, so I assume that's like no wind. Okay, I'll let you comment.
So if it faces the backyard, so there's no benefit in lighting towards the backyard. It's specifically Chalona Patuach L'Reshut HaRabim, a public facing, whether people light in their window facing their backyard, that just may come from, the development of a practice of lighting in a window, but not understanding the full intent of what lighting in the window is supposed to accomplish.
Yeah. Okay. Last thing, somebody just was asking for the author of the book you showed earlier.
Bill, it's in the source sheet, which is posted on the excellent.
It's on the website. The source sheet on the website.
But it's Bill Bryson at Home, which is a history of the home. And I also just used some Wikipedia articles there on the history of glassmaking and the history of windows. You could look all that up.
Thank you. Okay, Rabbi Samuels will be back next Thursday night giving the Parsha Shir, which is how this whole thing began, actually. But that's a whole other story. And a pleasure. Thank you very much. Always interesting.